The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The motivation for this talk today is the topic of compassion, but it's possible that if I hadn't told you that, you wouldn't know. So you might want to keep this in mind. So there is a fable, I don't know where it's from, but there's a fable of a monarch who wanted to find the wisest person in the realm. And so had the royal ministers round up four of the people that many, that were considered kind of the wisest of the realm, and wanted to find out which one was the wisest. So these were rounded up, and they were thrown into the royal dungeon. Mm-hmm. And we're told that unless they found a way out in 3 or 4 hours, it would be off with their heads. And with that, the door was slammed shut, and they were left inside the dungeon. And when they looked at the door, it had a big, complicated lock, combination of combinations and keyholes and whatever else, puzzles. And on the floor next to the door was a box of tools. So as three of them began studying the lock, bringing out the tools, tinkering with the lock, trying to figure out how this lock worked. And one of them sat back on the back wall of the dungeon and just rested, looking at the door. And the three, they were trying to figure out the lock as the hour or 2 hours went by and time was running out. You can imagine. Off were their heads, they heard. And so one of them got really angry, furious, the monarch, the injustice of it all. The other became really afraid and started running around the room like a trapped rat. And the third became completely depressed, ready to give up, it's hopeless. And the fourth, calmly looking at the door. And when the time got close to the time, the 3 hours were up, the one sitting down got up and walked to the door and pushed it open. Because it had never been locked. There was a lock on the door, but they never considered the fact that maybe the door wasn't locked to begin with. Just this thing, big thing hanging on it. So the basis of the activity, the investigation, the problem solving, the basis of the emotional life of the first three was based on the notion of there's a lock, there's a problem here that has to be solved. We could say maybe the fourth one didn't see a problem. Maybe the fourth one understood something, wasn't caught by the issue in the same way. And so this idea that our thinking, our way we see the world and see ourselves, has a basis, and that basis by which we see our life and see the world might not be an accurate basis. We might not be seeing things accurately. And it's possible to free ourselves from these inaccurate bases, and see things in a very different way. Is the premise of Buddhism. And it's a premise which is often overlooked or difficult to really grasp or understand because it's very hard to step out of our usual way of thinking and imagine that there's any other way. And so even if we might hear Buddhist teachings, it's incorporated into our existing way of thinking. And sometimes it's helpful, the Buddhist teachings, but it keeps us in the old basis. It's old kind of issues that are there. And so even the practice of mindfulness, as powerful and significant as can be, is sometimes incorporated into the old thinking. And it might make us more capable, more functional, more balanced, going through the world in the old way of thinking. But mindfulness wasn't designed to make us calmer, more peaceful in the old basis of thinking. It was designed to offer us a radically different, I could say, basis for how we see the world and see ourselves. But I think the preferred way in Buddhism is to not so much say it's an alternative basis, but to be without a basis. So what's that? And so it's a whole different, you know, a shift, and some people might say a paradigm shift that it involves. And it's so hard to see a paradigm shift if we're kind of caught in one. I saw this weekend, I went to the Exploratorium with my 10-year-old son, and there was a puzzle. It's a very simple puzzle. I don't know if I can describe it. There was a picture of two horses galloping, and they were, you saw the side, and they were kind of just, one was galloping one direction, the other direction, and they were kind of feet to feet. And then there was a plank of wood that had two riders on it. And you had to figure out how, the way the riders were positioned, how to place this plank with the riders on top of the flat one picture of two horses, so that they would be, the riders would be riding horses. And what the puzzle required was not to try to get the riders to ride the horses as they were seen, as you saw them, but rather the way that you could turn the plank with the riders 90 degrees and overlay part of the horses in such a way that the head of one became, the head of one and the butt of the other horse became one horse. So that probably, I don't know if I explained that very well, but you had to kind of see the whole thing. You had to kind of not see the puzzle as being solving the horses that were there. You had to make new horses to make the puzzle work. Or the famous puzzle of the nine dots in a box, right? How do you get with three lines to connect all the dots? Well, you have to leave the box and come back, right? So once you see it, it's obvious. Once you see that the old way of thinking is not the way to solve the problem, there's another way of seeing it, then it's obvious from then on, and it becomes boring pretty quickly. So Buddhism is pointing to this other way, other basis. And perhaps it doesn't make, perhaps it's pointless to talk about it. Maybe there's no way of kind of understanding with that kind of thing. But so, I look at my life, and I could see that looking back at the history of my life, that I built my life at various times upon certain basis. And so all my thinking, my problem solving, my everything was upon that. And one of the interesting moments I had was in second year in college, and I became very self-conscious, aware of how much I was concerned about how other people saw me. It was like really kind of, I think much of my thinking, I could not think that way. If I saw someone, I'd be thinking, well, how are they judging me? How are they seeing me? And all that. And it was kind of very painful to live this way. And then I was riding my bike through the college town. And I thought, what would it be like if I was invisible? So I imagined myself invisible. I think I did a pretty good job. Because then I kind of, if I'm invisible, they can't see me. If they can't see me, they can't judge me. And I got to feel a very different way of being in the world. I felt much freer and happier. Or when I was younger, it went the other way. When I was 19, I went to, I guess around the same time, I went to Morocco. And after a while of being in Morocco, I noticed that my mind, there was a part of my mind that was fresher, more relaxed or more open or something different. I could tell something different. And I kind of tried to understand what it was, and I realized that what it was the men back then in Morocco wore yalabas, wore these kind of long gowns kind of thing. And I'd never been in a culture where men didn't wear trousers and this kind of Western clothes like this. And I had no basis upon which to judge them the way I did in, back in the US of A, where I would be concerned with that guy's a jock, that guy's a businessman, that guy is this. I had all these categories. I would immediately kind of put people in categories. I knew them because of how they were dressed. And I couldn't do that in Morocco because I hadn't, you know, I didn't know what that meant. Maybe it meant something in Morocco, but I couldn't tell. And I could feel the relaxation of not having this ideation, this conceptualization, this judging going on. I was free for temporarily of a basis of thinking. For a while, the basis of my thinking was insecurity, a variety of different kinds of insecurity. So how I saw the world was through the filter of solving that insecurity. And so, you know, everything was about that. Until I discovered that I didn't have to be thinking or considering myself as being insecure. I might be. I mean, you know, it's pretty easy to think. It's very easy if you want to think that your life is insecure. It's very easy to do that. In fact, some Buddhist teachers love to tell you, your life is really insecure. If you only knew. And if your basis of thinking about life is already insecure, then it just adds fire, gasoline to the fire, right? But is it necessary to keep that as a basis, always problem, always solving, trying to fix the problem? The one of the basis for that's is has to do with self-identity. That we have in it, we've been somehow from our family, our society, our life experiences, we have an idea about who we are. And it's there as a basis for all our thinking, but it's kind of invisible. It's kind of like the background, or it's the grammar for how we think. We might know how we're thinking, but we don't see the grammar that constructs it. So the grammar, there's a subject, there's me, and I'm this way. And there can be a lot of different things that we carry with us. I've gone through a whole cornucopia of identities in my lifetime, who I think I am, and then everything's about, you know, trying to fit that or hide that or reinforce that or defend that or solve that or do something with that, that identity, that idea of who I am. And with that identity of who I am comes the identity of who other people are, from self and others, and I'm this way, they're that way. And it could seem very obvious. It can seem like that's just completely natural part of life to be this way, because maybe if family grow up, we have a family identity or an ethnic identity or national identity that has been told this is important to have. It's how we understand ourselves. It's how we understand ourselves against the rest of the world. So we need to keep that going and defend it and keep it and all that. And there's nothing wrong with any, most identities, I mean, ethnic identities, national identities, all kinds of identities. But when we see it as a basis of our thinking and a worldview, do we see it as optional or not? Do we pick it up and involve with it when it's useful? Or do we? Is it always there as the orientation, the way we understand our life? So, you know, I've had those things. I was born in a foreign country, and when I was in my teenage years, maybe 20s, the idea of not being an American, not being from the United States, was an important part of my identity, partly because of the Vietnam War and what America was doing. It's like, oh, you know. And so I remember in 1974, I went to the New Year's Eve Grateful Dead concert in San Francisco. So that was kind of interesting. But the big surprise when I got there and saw these Grateful Dead, I was kind of shocked. They're American. They're like 100%. I couldn't believe how American they were. They were more American than hippies or whatever, you know. Like, wow, you know, because I didn't identify with that part, you know. And I suppose a lot of the hippies at that time, that the fact that the Grateful Dead were American was not the identity they saw them through. They saw them through the counterculture. But because where I came from, I saw them a certain way. So we have identities, you know, all kinds of identities, ideas of who we are, we operate under. And these get very, very subtle. So subtle that sometimes even the idea that I am, that I exist, is a basis of thinking, basis of orientation, basis of part of this problem solving we're doing. And of course you exist, right? And of course we have to kind of find our way in life. So because we exist, because we have to find our way in life, it seems of course we should be thinking this way. Of course we should be problem solving this way. This is how it is. And the idea of not problem solving or not orienting that way, if you feel insecure, the idea of not thinking about how to be safe, it just produces more fear. It's inconceivable. Like, why would you do that? How do you find your way? You're not safe then. Or if you're not only your life has been built on having identity, but your family and society has done a great job in cooperating in insisting you have an identity. They treat you as an identity. They treat you a certain way, so you're that kind of person. And if everyone's conspiring to see you that way, it's inconceivable not to be that way. In fact, if you're not that way, don't think that way, again, you're not safe, you're not cooperating with the status quo, and, it's just, where are you? And just like the wise men, the three first wise men, all these things, our identity, our orientations, our desires, our fears, all these things that can create the basis of our thinking and our approach can stimulate our emotional life. And our emotional life can be quite activated because our identity is threatened. Because, having our desires fulfilled is what seems important, then if our desires are not satisfied, it could be frustrating, angry, we can get depressed and everything. So the question for a Buddhist practitioner is, or the issue, one of the tasks of a Buddhist practitioner is to understand what is the basis upon which I base my life? What is the view, the opinion, the idea of what's important, of who I am, or what's the problem I have in my life? Do we understand that basis? And then it's very easy then, if you understand it, to address the problem in the old paradigm. I have an identity which is not serving me, and I better become the person who doesn't have the identity. And then you tie yourself in knots trying to be the person who doesn't have the identity, right? And not seeing the paradox of that. So in the practice of mindfulness too, we could practice meditation practice or mindfulness practice with a very strong sense that I'm the one who's doing it. And I'm doing it for certain purposes, I'm doing it in order to attain, solve my problems. But if my problem stems from some kind of unexamined basis, it's possible that the mindfulness will help you cope better in your life and things are more comfortable and nicer and you have more wisdom understanding what's going on. But it's never addressed, the practice never turns around and goes deep inside to address this, the core thing. So one of the teachings of Zen that I'm very fond of, a little, or more like a cliche, is that practice involves taking the backward step. Or practice involves taking the mirror of attention and turning it around 180 degrees to be able to look deep back down inside, below the way in which we objectify the world, the way in which we're trying to solve our problems, the ways in which we're trying to run away from our pain. Pain is one of these bases upon which everything else kind of mushrooms from. We react to pain. So to go back and look behind deeply. So I'll give you a little example. Occasionally there are people who are very motivated to find a meaning of their life. They're searching for the meaning of the life. If you take the backward step and look back, you wouldn't be trying to answer the question, what's the meaning of my life? But rather you would look and say, why am I asking this question? What's motivating the question? And my theory is that the stronger the drive is to search for the meaning for life, the more likely the basis for that is fear or some kind of personal pain trying to deal with. And what happens if instead of solving the question of the meaning of life, you solve the fear, or you dissolve the fear, or dissolve the pain? The issue of meaning of life still remains, but it maybe doesn't have the same importance anymore. It's like, oh, you know, I'll take it or leave it. You know, it's because the emotional basis of our life is no longer dependent on solving it that way. So, if you keep your hand in a fist the whole time, then and that's all you know. Then the problem might be you're constantly orienting your life around having a fist, and how do you manage to get through your life with a fist, and how do you get things done with a fist, and you know, and it's, you can probably do a lot with a fist, you know. But then, if you realize you don't need to have a fist, you can open your hand, then it's a whole different world that we're living in. So the same thing with we have fists in our hearts and our minds. We're contracted or tight in various ways. And if we assume that the inner contraction, the inner tightness, is the way things are supposed to be, then the task would be how to figure out go through life with that fist in the heart, with that contraction or that pain. But the task of practice is to open that hand of the heart, to open the fist of the heart, and to see there's another way. And here's where it's kind of inconceivable, this realm, because this realm doesn't belong to concepts. So it's kind of like if you apologize for this invention of a word, it's unfistable to imagine a hand without fists, right? It doesn't. A fist. Where does a fist go when you open your hand? What's the existential status of the fist when you open your hand? You know, where did it go? Poof! I'm a magician. That's, you know. You can, you know, the sleight of hand. The fist is gone. So the so it's inconceivable because it doesn't belong to the world of concepts. It doesn't belong to the world of thinking about. In fact, thinking about freedom, thinking about this letting go, releasing the fist, I mean, it's obvious, if you think about letting go of the fist, that's not letting go of the fist, right? So thinking about letting go of the fist in your heart is not letting go. And so it's inconceivable what this is like, because what it's like doesn't belong to the world of concepts or conceiving. And so it's a kind of like, well, where do I stand? What do I do? I mean, I don't know any other way. That's all I've known my whole life. So it's inconceivable. I have to conceive of it. If I can't conceive of it, how do I know I'm safe? If I'm not can't conceive of it, how do I know I can find my way through life? So, if I'm kind of like this bell that I'm holding, and I'm really clutching tight to me, and I use me as a sledgehammer to get what I want in the world, so, you know, I get that. Or if I hold on tight and hold it close in, I'm not going to, open up to anybody. I get that, right? But if I kind of figure out a variety of things, do some mindfulness practice, learn to relax a little bit, learn not to be so caught up in ideas, learn to be equanimous about my anger, not be so caught up in my concepts and ideas, fit into society and the way society wants us to fit in nicely. And then society and I meet and it's night. Oh, great. Now I'm one of the attractive people. And this is great. Being an attractive person is one of the very important basis of life. Some people orient their whole basis orientation becoming attractive. So, well, I did it and mindfulness helped. Some of the glossy magazines now that are coming out around mindfulness and the pictures of it give that impression that you'll be a very attractive person. I'll be wearing yoga clothes. So, but as much as this is nice and wonderful, it's, it's no guarantee it's going to stay this way. And any time, because there's uncertainty principle, all kinds of things can happen, right? And so what do you do? Hide the self, make a bigger self, get richer, bigger house, take martial arts so you can learn more, get a PhD in Buddhism, do something, right, to kind of like, do something good with this thing, right? But there's another option, and this is the option of Buddhism, the core option. And so look what happens. So if I have the striker in my right hand and the bell in the left, it does that, right? And if I put the bell down, so there's nothing in my left hand, but the striker is still in my right hand, striker is the world, and I hit with a striker. It doesn't hit anything. There's nothing there to hit. It's possible to make the mind, so it's possible for the mind, the heart, the inner life, when it's based on a basis, when it's founded on some principle, idea, ideation, identity, desires, fears, and all these things, the heart, the mind, becomes a lightning rod. It's possible for the mind to be like an endless, empty, clear sky. And this paradigm shift of Buddhism is to go from having a mind which is a lightning rod for something that's going to hit it, come along and hit, and have a mind which is like an empty sky. So if I have an identity, if I need to be an attractive person, and I'm attractable by the clothes I wear, and some of you really don't like men who wear blue shirts, and you let me know. So what happens is that you're telling me, you know, men with blue shirts are just lousy, then that those words come like lightning, and I have a rod up. I have this basis, this idea, this ideation, and it's going to hit that idea. Oh, no. This is the very thing I was most afraid of coming to IMC today, that someone was going to judge me for my clothes. It proves it. So next time we're going to come when some other way. I won't even come at all. It's too dangerous. So I'm kind of in this world. But if I don't, not thinking, I have no thoughts at all about what you think about my clothes. I just don't, you know, it's not a concern of mine. I don't care. I don't not care. Even not caring can be based on a basis. This paradigm shift doesn't even involve not caring. Just not there. Then you might tell me that, you know, men with blue shirts are lousy. And it's kind of like it just those words still occur. They heard in the mind, but rather than hitting my lightning rod, they just go right through. There's nowhere they land, nowhere they touch. So this has to do with compassion. Now, remember at the beginning I said this talk was about compassion. Compassion is a beautiful quality, an important aspect of life. Empathy is very, very beautiful and wonderful. It's one of the great treasures of human life is that people can have empathy for each other and understand and feel what's going on. But that capacity of empathy is a world of difference if the empathy, the compassion, is experienced in the world of having a basis, the world of these identity and ideas and fears and kind of concepts by which we implicitly, sometimes unconsciously, are organizing our life, versus compassion that's operating in a mind that has no basis. And one of the bases that compassion can and empathy can operate under, there's many of them, but is I am the one who's experiencing someone suffering. Of course it's you, if you're experiencing it, but it's not an innocent thing to say, I'm the one who's experiencing it. And chances are, as soon as you say, I'm the one experiencing it or operating that way, it's a magnet for all kinds of other ideas you have about what it means to be I, to be me. I'm responsible. I have to look a certain way. I have to respond a certain way. This is going to impact my rest of my life. I can't open to this because it's too demanding. Just go on and on the list of things. Or I have a responsibility. This means a lot. You know, all kinds of stuff. And it can part of the way that compassion can be a drain is some of these bases and ideas that we have, how we pick it up and relate to it, are quite challenging. And then it's possible to become wise about this compassionate world and stay in the world of a basis, but just rearrange the deck chairs in the Titanic so it's more comfortable as you go down. You know, or just kind of make it work in a more conventional way, make it work for the society you're in or something. But it's a world of difference to have compassion in the heart that is like an empty sky. To experience compassion without the self-identity rising up to meet that. It's a world of difference, a whole paradigm shift to not take it on as personal responsibility or see it through the filter of me, myself, and mine. I have to do this, it's up to me, this is happening to me. Even the idea that it's happening to me, I'm experiencing someone's pain, is extra, it's part of the old basis. So this radical aspect of Buddhism is pointing to this possibility of being in the world, experiencing the world, experiencing what goes on, And being alert and present to it, which is pretty amazing when people can be that way, but have it kind of not have it hit a lightning rod, not have it touch a basis, not have it touched, to let it be experienced in the inconceivable capacity of the mind, the capacity of the mind that doesn't have to think exactly about it. You can still think, but that part of you doesn't have to relate it to a basis, to a worldview, to an assumption, to ideations, to concepts, to all this stuff. It doesn't have to see it even from the point of view of self versus other. You're suffering and I am experiencing your suffering. Some people will describe this alternative paradigm as being the subject and object falls away. Your suffering is my suffering. Just there's no difference. And this new paradigm of Buddhism, of liberation, of liberated heart, and this is where it gets even more, I think, tricky for the old paradigm to appreciate. It's kind of like there is no problem. There's no problem here. It's possible to be present for someone and feel the old feelings of pain, sharing their pain, having compassion. Let it wash through. In fact, the more free you are, the less overlay of concepts you have, my experience has been, the more fully you feel the world. But it becomes cleaner. And so, isn't this like a terrible idea that you can experience someone suffering, feel compassion, and not see it as a problem? I mean, isn't that like awful? Doesn't that make you a bad person? In the old paradigm, in the way that that thinking of self and I and ideas of what you should be, it does make you kind of a bad person, kind of. But hopefully you get tired of the old paradigm. So what is it to have compassion, to be present, and not see a problem? What I see is that what it leaves us with, in that open heart, it leaves us then to allow the heart to respond in its way. And you hear, I said that very carefully, allow the heart to respond in its way as opposed to letting you respond. It's kind of like you don't have to respond. You kind of, you know, you're not there in a certain way because the you that's always been there is the you that's built on ideas and concepts and histories and pasts and imagined futures and lessons we've learned and emotions and fears around what it means to be a person. But if all that is put to rest and to relax and to trust the open heart and trust the space of not needing to have a problem, not needing to solve anything in the usual way, but to allow the heart to respond. And will the heart respond adequately? I hope. Will it respond adequately? One answer to that question, again, because you're always looking at the, you know, the problem, the solve it. What's the other way? What's the other paradigm? The other way, and this is the classic Buddhist way to solve this problem, is it adequate? Is to appreciate that all the alternative ways of responding involve suffering. And who wants to pick up a hot skillet? A hot, you know, touch a hot stove. So all the other ways of suffering, so, you know, it has to work this way. And then if you see some of the people who are most mature in the practice, they tend to have a lot of care and compassion for the world, and they tend to respond in nice ways, in good ways. But they tend not to take credit for it, or tend not to be so caught up in what it means for them. So I offer you this talk as a way of both talking about the radical nature of the Buddhist message. And Buddhism historically has periodically, regularly kind of made a kind of dichotomy between the world of samsara and the world of nirvana, the world of clinging and the world of a basis, and the world, the mental world, which is free of basis. And that the practice that we do is not a practice to help us get along and cope better in life as it is. It does help. So that's all you want. Great, you're in the right place. But it's not about that. The core aspect of it is to help dissolve these deep, deep structures of thought and ideas and clinging that is the basis of our life, to experience this whole other possibility, this whole other paradigm. And so I offer you this then for two reasons. One is so that if you appreciate that, then perhaps you can not be so strongly wedded to doing the practice from the old paradigm. And the other is to offer you a radical different approach to what it means to be compassionate than maybe you've ever imagined. The idea of compassion existing in that mind, heart, which is like an empty sky. And then I'll end now with a change of analogies. So hopefully you can manage this change. So in that empty sky-like world where everything can flow freely through, that your compassion is like this. There's no obstacles in space for the traveling of that sound. The sound just is there in that space. And so it is with compassion. So I hope that made some sense. If it didn't make any sense, then maybe I'm on track.